Interrupt me at any time. I wouldn't have put it quite that way, but okay. So it's great to be back here. Always great to be back in Waterloo. So even in the winter. So I wanted to tell you about the computational complexity of linear optics, and this is a new departure for me because it was only a couple months ago that I learned what linear optics is. But there's really, really an amazing model of computation here. And for some reason, when people talk about it, they always obscure it with all this physics. So what we're gonna do today is try to see what I mean. In other words, the situation seems similar to the situation of quantum mechanics itself before quantum information came along, right? In other words, the physicists, have a language that they talk among themselves, and then the rest of us are kind of shut out. But I want to see if we can change the situation. Oh, and I should mention that this is joint work with Alex Arkhipov, who's a senior at MIT. So the sort of overall goal here was to find new evidence that quantum mechanics is really hard to simulate on classical computers. Okay, so what is the evidence that we have, and why isn't it good enough? Okay, well, you all know the most famous evidence, right? That you build a quantum computer, you can factor, okay, and then you can read people's email. Look, this has a lot going for it. Solves a beautiful problem, easy to state. Has been considered studied for thousands of years. Part of the world's economy is based on it. It also as evidence for the power of the computational power of quantum mechanics. This also, sure, and the other sort of known quantum algorithms that achieve exponential speedups also have some disadvantages. So what are the disadvantages? Well, there's an obvious one. They seem to correspond to experiments that are, or so the experimenters tell us, are damn hard to implement. Okay, and we if quantum mechanics is true, we believe that ultimately it's possible, but but right now we're up to 15, and for the last decade or so, we've been repeatedly factoring 15 into 3 times 5, right? I don't think 21 has been done yet, right? And then the second computer science-y point is that there's not actually a universal consensus among cryptographers that factoring is a hard problem classically. I mean, I believe that it's hard. But on the other hand, I wouldn't bet my life on that, this in the same way that I would bet my life that P is not equal to NP, let's say. Okay, so factoring is a very special problem, right? It's not. It's very different from the NP complete problems, we believe, in that it has all this sort of number theoretic structure. Indeed, it's precisely that structure that Shor exploited to give his factoring algorithm. Okay, but it raises the question of whether one could exploit the same structure by a classical algorithm. Okay, and in fact, we know classical algorithms that are much, much better than the naive one. They take something like 2^n⁓ time, where n is the number of digits, right? So there are very non-obvious classical algorithms, and so we believe that there's no polynomial time one, but maybe we're wrong, right? And so it would be nice to have evidence that quantum computers are hard to simulate, which isn't based on such a specific problem with so much structure to it. Okay, so and then the third thing, maybe this is more of a nerdier reason, but I'll put it anyway. It's the yes, you know, we think that factoring is not in P, but you know, it is in classes that are complexity classes that are only a little bit above P in some sense. So we know that you know, factoring is an NP problem. Okay, so if you can always prove that a number has a prime factor ending in a 7, let's say, or that it doesn't have any prime factor ending in 7 by just showing someone the factorization. Okay, and then they can check that yes, indeed, you know, this is the factorization, and so you get what's called an NP intersect co-NP problem. Okay, so so what this means is that problems like factoring are never going to give us evidence that that BQP is even outside of NP, or in other words, that that not only can a classical computer not solve not simulate a quantum computer, but there's not even a short classical proof that like a quantum computer produces a certain output. Okay, which is a stronger thing that we might want to know. Okay, you know, and more generally, you know, we would like to know whether BQP, and there's been a very old problem of whether BQP is contained in the polynomial hierarchy or not. Okay, so what is this polynomial hierarchy? Well, it's a generalization of NP. So it includes NP, also NP with an oracle for NP, also NP with an oracle for NP with an oracle for NP. And so on. Okay, so basically, NP questions are questions like, does there exist a string that satisfies these constraints? Right. So, okay. So, you know, if there is a such a string, you can check it quickly, right? And but you know, it might take exponential time to find such a string. Okay, if you don't know what it is. Okay, so these are NP problems, and this includes like threesat, you know, Hamilton path, all of our favorite kinds of examples of hard, sort of combinatorial problems. Now, like NP to the NP is similar, except that now we get two quantifiers. Now we can ask questions like, does there exist an x such that for every y, phi of xy is satisfied? Okay, so you can imagine a two-player game where first Alice moves and then Bob moves, and the question is, you know, and then there's some function that computes who wins as a function of, you know, their moves, and the question is, does Alice or does Bob have the winning strategy in this game? Okay, and then, you know, likewise for NP to the NP, you get three quantifiers. Okay, so you get this hierarchy of, and then the polynomial hierarchy is just the union of all these things. Okay, so you get this hierarchy of classes above NP, and it turns out to show up all the time in theoretical computer science. One of its main applications is sort of as a yardstick of implausibility. Okay, so very often you'll see results that take the form, if such and such is true, then pH collapses to a finite level. Okay, there are many, you know, dozens of results of this form. Okay, and basically what, you know, this is complexity speak for, well, you know, such and such is probably false. Okay, and we can't prove it, but you know, we can give pretty good evidence. Okay, and yeah.
This is a question. So thinking about it, I think I've convinced myself that the problem you give for NP to the NP, exists X for all Y, is not in NP. But I'm trying to figure out why it's in NP to the NP. Because I've never thought about NP to NP, so I'm thinking, okay, I've got an NP machine with access to an NP oracle.
Okay, so in NP to the NP, you can say you can non-deterministically guess an X, right? And then you can feed the NP oracle the question, does there exist a Y that makes the formula false given this X, right? And if that oracle, So like you can sort of reverse the quantifier, right? You can use the fact that for all x is the same thing as not there exists an x such that not, right? You know, like you can, okay, so the Morgan's law, I think it's called, right? So you can ask like, so NP gives you the power of not just guessing something, right? So you say, does there exist an x such that, and now, you know, now that you can query this oracle, now you can sort of reverse the query, okay? You can ask like,
that breaks that x.
Yeah.
That sounds more like co-NG.
No. You're asking for existence. You're still asking about existence, right? Does there exist a lot?
But the point is that it's an NP oracle, so it decides NP, so there's kind of not really any asymmetry anymore. Like an NP oracle is equivalent to a co-NP oracle.
Right, exactly. So, all right, but yeah. Thank you, Daniel. So the point is when you're calling an oracle, right, then whatever answer it gives, you can just flip the answer. Right, so only at the very bottom of the stack does it matter whether you're NP or co-NP. Right, you know, for any place higher, you can just take the answer and flip it if you like. All right, it's a little bit, you know, maybe the better way to think of it is just like this: just forget about the oracles. Okay, all right, so so just like, you know, we believe that P is not equal to NP, right? A generalization of that belief says that the polynomial hierarchy is infinite, right? So, okay, so if P equals NP, then the entire hierarchy basically just collapses down like a steamroller, okay? So it just flattens out because then, like, NP to the NP to the NP would equal NP to the NP to the P would equal NP to the P would equal P to the P, so, you know, everything becomes P, right? But on the other hand, it could be the case, let's say, that that the hierarchy would collapse to some higher finite level, even if P is not equal to NP, right? And so, but it seems unlikely. Okay, with the same intuition that, you know, by which it's unlikely that P equals NP, we also believe that this whole hierarchy goes on infinitely. And, you know, if you believe that, then that implies a lot of other things that, you know, we would like to prove in computer science, you know, that as usual we can't prove.
Not collapsing?
I would stake my nibs on it not collapsing. So, indeed, in this talk, we're going to have results of this same form. That, okay, that if you believe this, and by the way, I would certainly believe that it's infinite, even conditioned on factoring being in P, let's say, right? Because, you know, this seems much closer to, like, P not equal to NP or something like that. So we're going to see how if you assume that the polynomial hierarchy is infinite, then that gives you some sort of evidence that quantum computers are hard to simulate classically. Okay, so... So in this talk, you know, I want to tell you about new evidence that, you know, quantum mechanics is hard to simulate classically, and it fixes all three of these disadvantages that I listed here. Although, you know, as you would probably guess, at the cost of introducing other disadvantages. But you know, let's start with the positive. Okay. Yeah.
Like parentheses to see if PQP lies in the polynomial hierarchy.
Yeah.
And evidence for that would say that quantum mechanics is hard to simulate. Are there other reasons to care about this?
Other reasons to care?
About why it lies in the polynomial hierarchy or not?
Okay. Well. So first of all, so here's one reason to care. If BQP was in the polynomial hierarchy, that would mean that. If P equals NP, then also P equals BQP. Right? So it would mean that, you know, that these two questions are connected, or, you know, in that way, right? If it's not, then it could be the case that quantum computers give you an advantage, you know, and we're still in business, you know, even if P equals NP. Yeah, this one. Okay, you know, another thing is if you're I mean there's a number of questions where, like, you know, they would turn out like what would be the consequences of NP being in BQP, okay, where the story looks very, very different compared, like depending on whether BQP is in AM or not. All right, so if it's in, especially in some low level of the polynomial hierarchy, right? Okay, like if BQP was in AM, then that would mean that quantum computers can't solve NP-complete problems unless the polynomial hierarchy collapses. Okay, so, you know, and we can't even get evidence that, we can't even get as good evidence as we'd like that BQP is not in AM, you know, let alone that it's not in the polynomial hierarchy. So, you know, these are some reasons why I care. But, yeah.
Marginally less nerdy take on the same question. Suppose I come up with an algorithm that solves a problem that's not in NP, or, you know, God forbid, maybe it's not even in PH.
Yeah.
Given that I can't even verify the solution, is this good for anything?
So one example of such a question might be simulating quantum mechanics, right? Simulating a quantum system, right? So, I mean, do we believe that that's good for something? I mean, it seems like we probably do, right? But I mean, there are several things to say about this. One is that we know even problems that are not in NP, often they have interactive protocols, right? Or there's some other way that you can verify the correctness of the solution. You may have heard about this recent breakthrough, I think, in a blind quantum computation, right? That, you know, gives you a way to verify the output of a quantum computation, even if it's not solving an NP problem, you know, given only some very minimal assumptions. So even if a problem is not in NP, you know, all hope is not lost for proving the answer to someone. Okay, so, you know, that's the first thing to say, right? But, you know, another thing to say is, if quantum computers can really do things, you know, where a classical computer can't even check the answer, right? That by itself is very interesting to know, right? I mean, at a fundamental level, we're interested in just what kinds of resources are needed to simulate quantum mechanics, right? And even if we know that, you know, classical computers can't do it efficiently, right, the question still stands of, you know, can you just go to some higher level in the hierarchy and then simulate it, right? So, Okay, so these are a few things I'm interested in, but, you know, if you don't care about the complexity stuff, there, you know, there will be also kind of a physics component to what I'll be talking about. But at least, you know, I think it's, you know, sort of physics. You'll have to meet me halfway. So if you don't like this motivation, I have others. Okay, so fine. So what are the advantages of new results? First of all, I'm going to be talking about a very weak subset of quantum computations. In fact, ones that can be implemented using only like linear optics, like beam splitters and phase shifters, and then single photon input states and non-adaptive measurements. So just a single measurement of all the photon numbers at the end. Okay. So this particular model, you know, seems. First of all, we can give evidence, in fact, that this model is not universal for quantum computation, you know, at least if you don't have adaptive measurements. And it definitely seems, you know, beyond present day technology to implement, especially coming up with these like reliable single photon sources, which I gather is a bit of a problem. But on the other hand, it seems, you know, from what I can gather, not as difficult as building a universal quantum computer. So maybe it's hard, but not as damn hard to implement. Okay, and let's see. Secondly, we're going to try to base our evidence on sort of more generic assumptions than that factoring is not in BPP. For example, as I mentioned before, that the polynomial hierarchy is infinite. This is an even more generic belief. I'll talk about this later. Okay, but and in some cases we'll achieve this, in other cases we won't. Okay, but this is the goal. Thirdly, we'll get evidence that quantum computers have capabilities outside outside the whole polynomial hierarchy. Okay, but I told you that there are also disadvantages. So, okay, so the first disadvantage is we're not going to be talking about the decision problems that are customary in computer science, okay, where you have a problem, you have an input, you want to produce some yes or no answer to it, right? We're going to be talking about problems where the output is a string and there could be many different valid outputs and your goal is just to output any one of them, okay? Or we can also talk about sampling problems where there's some probability distribution and your goal is to just produce a sample from something close to that distribution. Okay, now this is not actually such a big disadvantage because you can deal with these things also, right? And these seem perfectly fine to me. I don't know, but it's related to maybe a more serious disadvantage. Okay, factoring, being in NP, right, is a disadvantage, but it also has an advantage, which is that if you built a quantum computer that could factor 10,000 digit numbers, then, you could just hand the factors to, even to the biggest quantum computing skeptic in the world, and well, it wouldn't quite prove, they could multiply them, they can check that indeed they're the factors. Okay, and that doesn't quite prove that you have a quantum computer, but at least it proves that you have some kind of remarkable power, right? You factored this number, either the quantum way or you're just, really, really good at mental arithmetic or something. But it shows that, something amazing must have been accomplished, right? But with these problems, it's harder to even verify using a classical computer that you're even, doing the quantum computation correctly. Okay, but, I'll talk about how, nevertheless, I think that these sorts of problems could be used to get, to conceivably do like an experiment that would give some sort of evidence that that indeed quantum computers are doing something which is hard to simulate classically. Okay, crucial experiment which would test the extended Church Turing thesis. Okay, the extended Church Turing thesis, is the belief that everything that can be efficiently computed in the physical world can also be efficiently computed by a conventional Turing machine. Okay, and most often mentioned today as a straw man to be knocked over by quantum computing. Okay, so. But the fact remains, okay, if we believe quantum mechanics, is true, and we also believe that factoring is hard, right, then this extended Church-Turing thesis can't be right, okay? So, quantum mechanics is doing something that is you know, hard can in principle do something that's hard for classical computers, namely it can factor numbers. But you know, the fact remains that we haven't really seen direct evidence so far for the computational power of quantum mechanics. Okay, and in fact, I talk all the time to colleagues in computer science who just take it as obvious that quantum mechanics must break down before it becomes possible to build a quantum computer. And the argument for that is, well, you know, this has to be true, clearly, because otherwise you could factor numbers in polynomial time. Okay. So, you know, so really kind of the motivation for this talk is I would like, while I'm still alive, to force these people to admit that they're wrong. So that actually puts a harder constraint in some cases, but yeah. Okay, fine. So, and then thirdly, the problems we're talking about are not going to be obviously useful for anything, you know, in the sense that factoring is useful, at least if you're a spy or a bad guy. Okay, so, you know, what these things are useful for is, trying to refute the extended Church Turing thesis, basically. You could think of some application of sampling random matrices with somewhat larger than average permanence. If you can, please come talk to me. But, okay, fine. So, all right, so, you know, so I had results that, you know, like had this sort of profile in the Oracle world, and then I started wondering whether you could do something analogous in the non-Oracle or quote unquote real world, which for some reason people seem to care about more. I haven't figured out why, but so then this is what Alex Arkhipov and I tried to do. So QIP, I give a talk about both sets of results, but in this talk, I'd like to focus on sort of the real-world result, which has to do with, as advertised, the computational complexity of linear optics. Okay, so so what is linear optics? Well, I'm sure, you know, many of you in this room know much better than I do, but I'm going to just say like a few things that we'll need about it for this talk. Okay, so for our purposes, linear optics is a way to bring the permanent function into quantum computing. Okay, so you know that there are these two basic types of particles in the universe. You know, one of them is fermions, like here. The other one is bosons, like there. Okay, and you know, the from a computer science point of view, the amazing thing about them is that to calculate the amplitude for n fermions to evolve from one configuration to some other configuration, you have to take the determinant of some n by n matrix. Okay, so determinant, of course, is this function here, right? And the reason is that you have to sum over all n factorial ways that, you know, these n particles could evolve, assuming that these are identical particles. Okay, that's important. But then you also have to take, you know, since every time you swap to identical fermions, the phase of the universe gets multiplied by minus one, you also have to multiply by minus one to the power of the number of swaps. Okay, that just gives you the determinant. With bosons, it's almost the same, except that you take the permanent And that's just the same function. But without the minus signs, okay. And this looked like a small difference from a computational point of view. This is all the difference in the world, okay? Because the determinant happens to be efficiently computable, right, using Gaussian elimination, whereas the permanent, as Valiant proved 30 years ago, is a sharp p complete, okay? Which determinant is in p, permanent is sharp p complete. Does that mean? Basically, it means it's as hard as any counting problem. Is any problem that involves counting a number of solutions to some combinatorial problem. And in particular, we know from an amazing theorem of Toda from 1990 that that this class sharp p is actually at least as powerful as the entire polynomial hierarchy. Okay, so you have fermion amplitudes computable in P, boson amplitudes, if you could compute them, you could simulate the entire polynomial hierarchy. Okay, so I actually heard this amazing connection in a talk that a computer scientist, Avi Wigderson, gave 10 years ago, which was about the permanent versus the determinant. And he mentioned that some physicist had told him this, and he said, look, I really don't understand what a boson is, what a fermion is, but all I can tell you is that the boson's got the harder job. Okay, so in some sense, what this talk is going to be about is, can we, is that just a wisecrack, or can we actually formalize it? Okay, and what does that actually mean? Okay, so we can first talk about the case of fermions. In 2002, Valiant wrote this paper, which was called Quantum Computations That Can Be Simulated Classically in Polynomial Time. Hey, this was one of the few paper titles where actually the most important word in the title was that, okay? But he came up with this class of quantum computations that he called the match gate circuits. And he proved that that any quantum computer which is built only out of these gates can be simulated in P. Okay, and then shortly afterward, Terhel and DiVincenzo wrote a paper where they pointed out that what Valiant had done basically was he rediscovered fermions. Okay, and when you add ones into your string, this is a creation operator. When you delete ones from your string and replace them with zeros, this is an annihilation operator, right? When you everything just corresponds in a natural way to the physics of fermions. So in particular, although Valiant didn't put it this way at all, what he basically proved is that quantum computers that are built only out of fermions with non-interacting fermions can be simulated efficiently in polynomial time, okay, on a classical computer. And essentially, the reason for it is precisely this connection. It's the fact that the amplitudes for the particles to evolve to some configuration are given by determinants of matrices, or some generalization of the determinant called the Pfaffian, if you have creation and annihilation operators. But in any case, it's some linear algebraic function of a matrix, which is computable in P. Okay. Incidentally, I should say that this, what I mean by this non-interacting, okay? So what this means is that we're considering a computation that involves n identical fermions, which can move around. They can be, two of them can be swapped with each other, and they can be, they can get some phase on them and so forth. They can be put in superposition of, two different places, and They can, you know, different states can interfere with each other, but there's no actual, you know, physical process that's going to entangle a pair of fermions. Okay, so you know, does this mean that they're just all completely unentangled? And you know, and that would say that, well, of course you could simulate it classically, right? Well, that's not quite true, because sort of every two like identical fermions in the universe are somehow sort of automatically have a little bit of entanglement between each other built into them, just because of the rule in quantum mechanics that says that, well, you know, what happens when you swap them, right? So but what we mean by non-interacting is that you're not using anything except for that interaction, okay? Which, you know, I gather physicists sometimes call the exchange interaction, even though it's not an actual physical force. Okay, so what we mean is that fermions subject only to the exchange interaction cannot be used to build a universal quantum computer. Okay, if you could entangle pairs of fermions, like through the electromagnetic force or whatever, then certainly you can build a universal quantum computer. Likewise for bosons, if you can interact pairs of them. Okay, so but this, you know, was at least this very interesting fact about non-interacting fermions. So this is the question: what can we say about non-interacting bosons? Okay. So and here we encounter an apparent paradox, because you know, boson amplitudes are given by permanence, but we know from Valiant that permanent is sharp P complete. Right, so and that's really hard, right? You know, sharp P contains the whole polynomial hierarchy. So, you know, does this mean that quantum computers can somehow solve a sharp P complete problem, right? Well, you know, you can find in the literature people talking about this issue for, you know, a couple of decades, and, you know, so some of you have probably figured out already, well, you know, the answer is no. We certainly don't think so. And, and the problem is that the permanent of a matrix gives you the amplitude for n identical bosons to evolve to some particular configuration, right? And the amplitude can, you know, is then determines the probability, you know, that you'll observe them in that state. But it's not like you get to explicitly observe the permanent, right? Amplitudes are not directly observable. So if quantum mechanics is solving the sharp P complete problem, it's only doing so in a sort of very implicit sort of a sense, right? It's not doing it in a way that you get to explicitly measure the result. Okay, and so then people said, all right, well then forget it. Then, you know, not much is happening there. So you know, what I want to argue in this talk is that the truth is somewhere in between, okay? That actually, you know, already this sort of, you know, implicit computation of the permanent that happens with bosons, you know, already has some sort of fairly striking complexity consequences. You know, if you could actually take a system of bosons and simulate it with a classical computer, right? It doesn't mean that you could solve a sharp P complete problem, but it means something which is also very, it would imply something which is also very surprising. Okay, so. Okay, so all right. So how do we define a model of linear optics computation? Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
What is the property of the quantum state that corresponds to the permanent?
So that's just what I'm going to tell you right now.
Good question. Okay. How about this one? Oh, that's right. I'll just use this one. It's fine. Okay. So, okay. So what is our what is going to be our model? So, um, Okay, so we're going to consider a Hilbert space, which is spanned by lists of non-negative integers, okay, summing to n. Okay, and basically what this tells you is, so you can imagine that we have m buckets, okay, if the physicist's word for buckets is modes. Okay, and you know, in each one of these modes, there could be zero or more photons. Okay, you know, because these are bosons, you can have more than one in the same bucket. Okay, and that's important. But so basically, you have these m modes, and then you have n photons to distribute among the modes, and then your basis state is just going to record how many photons there are in each of the modes. Okay, and so. So now, we'll, for simplicity, we'll assume that you start with some standard initial state, which, for example, we could just take to be this, that says that modes 1 to n initially have one photon each, whereas modes n plus 1 up to m are unoccupied, okay, or the vacuum. We'll call that state I. Okay, given the initial state, what do we get to do? Well, we get to choose some m by m unitary matrix U, okay, that acts on the modes. Okay, you know, we can take any one we like, and then that would describe, you know, the evolution, you know, if in the case where there, where n is equal to 1, in the case where there's only one photon, in just sort of the obvious way, you would just, you know, you would have some amplitude for the photon to be in each mode, and then that vector of amplitudes would just get multiplied by u, right? But what happens when there's more than one photon, okay? Well, in that case, u has to get lifted to some larger unitary, right, on the exponentially larger space of all the possible configurations of all n photons, right? And so how does that happen? I apologize for those who already know this. So the space, the Hilbert space of all the n photon configurations has dimension m plus n minus 1 choose n. You can, you know, it's an exercise. And so U is going to induce a unitary V on that larger space as follows. So the key point here, is that every entry of the larger unitary V is going to be the permanent of some submatrix of the smaller unitary U. Okay, and here I'm using S is a shorthand for, you know, for this, T is a shorthand for this, and then U sub ST means that you look at U, which was your M by M unitary, and now you take the N by N submatrix that corresponds to sort of taking the ith row s sub I times and the jth column t sub j times. Okay, so like so for example, if s and t were both just n 0 0 0, right? If they just both had all the photons concentrated in the first mode, then you would just take the top left entry of U, and you would just repeat it, you know, n squared times to just make an n by n matrix, and then you take the permanent of that matrix, okay, and that, you know, and then you have to divide by this normalization factor, because otherwise the thing wouldn't be unitary, okay, and then that gives you your entry of the unitary that gives you the transition amplitude between these two basis states, S and T. Yeah, Richard. Yeah. 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 Yep. What? Well. In that case, so for that entry, then that particular entry of V. So we could call this S and call that T, right? So then that entry of V would just be equal to U 1 to the nth power times n factorial, right? Okay, and then you know for the other entries of V, it could be something more complicated, you know, apparently, since we're taking permanents of various submatrices of U. Okay, so, So actually the simplest, you can either give like a combinatorial proof that it's unitary, you know, you can just do the algebra and see that things work in the right way, you know, which of course is, you know, kind of horrendous, you know, or you could just sort of show that every such U can be realized as a product of elementary operations, right, like beam splitters and phase shifters, and each of these small operations is unitary, and therefore the whole thing must be. Right. And generally, you know, it's a very nice thing to me that actually many properties of I'll get a chance to talk about this later. But there's like various properties of this like permanence of submatrices of a unitary matrix, right? Which you could prove algebraically. Probably the simplest proof is just to construct this quantum process, and you know, and then use the fact that we know that because it's quantum, it's unitary.
Is that the permanent of a matrix?
Yeah, that is. Okay. That's the permanent of a matrix that has all U11s in it.
Okay.
Right.
Now,
because there's,
So U is a unitary.
Yes.
V
is also a unitary.
No, sorry. U sub ST. That's it.
U sub ST is not in general unitary. What it is, it's a submatrix of a unitary matrix. It's like a block inside of a unitary matrix where when I say block, I also allow for the possibility that there are repeated rows. Right? So we could take a row of U and take it twice. We could take, you know, like we could repeat a column of U several times. Right, but you know, but basically it's a submatrix of U. And by n submatrices. Okay. And you know, and the number of times we take each row or each column is just given by these estimates. So like if every S sub I and every T sub I is either 0 or 1, then it's just literally an n by n submatrix.
Yep.
Okay, with no repeats. Okay. So in the model that I'm assuming, after you've applied V, then you get to measure. You get to measure like the result in the computational basis. So for the physicists, you get to measure the occupation number of each mode, right, and then you output the result. Okay, and that's the whole computation that you get to do. Okay, so actually, assuming that your initial state is really this 1, 1, 1, you know, 0, 0, 0 thing. There's actually a simpler way to put it. You can notice that if your initial state is this, then only the first n columns of U are ever going to matter, right? Because the remaining columns just get, you know, killed off by the zeros. So we can say that really what's happening is you get to specify an m by n matrix U, sorry, an m by n matrix A whose columns are orthonormal vectors, right? So in other words, like an m by n submatrix of an m by m unitary matrix. Okay, and then you get to sample some submatrix B of U with probability equal to the absolute value of the permanent of B squared, you know, divided by this normalization factor. Okay, but if these are all 1 or 0, then it's just the, you know, you get to sample some n by n submatrix of this m by n column orthonormal matrix with probability that's just the permanent of the submatrix squared. Okay, so it's basically, in this model of computation, it's a model where you get to sample from these sort of weird probability distributions that are defined in terms of the permanence of various submatrices of a given matrix. Okay. Okay, so on this, yeah.
It's not important for the model that ends less than n.
It's important for the model that what?
That n is less than n.
Oh, no. You could take it with n much larger, but so I should mention that for us, we'll generally be interested in the setting where m, the number of nodes, is some polynomial, and n, the number of foci. Okay. So let's see. So how long can I go on? Maybe I should just say, you know, anyone who wants to leave, I won't be offended. okay. So all right, fine. So. Okay, so this defines what I'll call the boson sampling model of computation. Okay, so now what can we say about the power of this model? Okay, so, well, you know, some things that were known from previous work. First of all, you know, it's known from, you know, like work of a number of people. You know, I think, you know, it's maybe even Feynman's original paper from the 1980s. Certainly, it's implicit in papers of Seth Lloyd from the 90s. At the very least, this model of computation is no more powerful than your standard garden variety qubit-based quantum computer. Okay, and I mean, this is, you know, if we believe, you know, if, you know, we know that, like, quantum computers can simulate quantum mechanics, that's, you know, intuitively plausible, right? But, you know, the actual way that this would happen is if you want to take a boson circuit and simulate it in the gate model, you know, in the qubit model, then you would just, you know, have a system where your basis states look like this, where now S1 up to SM are integers that you've written out in binary, let's say. Okay, and then you would use a known fact, which is that
Okay, so you can, any M by M unitary matrix can be decomposed into a product of at most O of M squared sort of local unitaries, where local means that it acts non-trivially on only one or two of the modes. Okay, you know, in the linear optic setting, these would correspond physically to beam splitters or phase shifters. Okay, so, you know, your basic kind of optical hardware. Okay, so what you could do is just, you know, and furthermore, this decomposition can be found efficiently. Okay, so what you could do is just decompose your U in this way, and then just, you know, each of these local steps, these beam splitters and phase shifters, these U sub i's, you could then simulate its action on the state, like in the qubit model, by just, you know, kind of acting on those two modes. And, you know, that's only some unitary polynomial dimension, and you can certainly implement it in the gate model. Okay, so, okay, so this was the first fact. The second, it might actually be new. I'm not sure if this was known before, but boson sampling can actually be simulated in the qubit model by only logarithmic depth quantum circuits. Okay, and this is okay. So, like, if any of you like have seen like Hawaii, every stabilizer circuit, right? Like every circuit that appears in the Gottesman-Knill theorem can be simulated, can be made into a logarithmic depth circuit. It's basically the same idea as that. You can, you know, if you can, you can parallelize your beam splitters and phase shifters in order to, you know, only use a logarithmic number of layers of them. Okay, so this is a simple fact, but in particular, this gives us some sort of evidence that whatever boson sampling is doing, it's probably not doing something which is universal for quantum computation. Okay, unless we believe that every quantum computation can be made logarithmic depth, which would be very surprising. Okay. Okay, so we don't have universality on this model, but on the other hand, there is a very famous result that says we're only missing one ingredient. Okay, so there's the famous result of Gnil, Laflamme, and Milburn from 2001 that says that if you just have this linear optics model that we're talking about with, you know, single photon Fock states as input and beam splitters and phase shifters, but then furthermore, you're able to make measurements of a photon number at some intermediate point and then condition on the outcomes of those measurements, so do something, you know, based on what you see, then you can actually build a universal quantum computer in this way. Okay, so, you know, in our setting, we're going to assume that all the measurements are just one shot. You just make them, you know, you measure all the photon numbers, and then you're done. Okay, so that's the difference there. Thank you. Okay. And okay, so some other facts that I can briefly mention. One of them is that it's possible to approximate the probability that any particular mode, that any particular outcome will be output to within a plus or minus 1 over polynomial additive error. Okay, so all right. And this is due to a very beautiful result of Leonid-Gurvitz. So if A is any matrix that's either unitary or a a submatrix of a unitary matrix, then you can approximate its permanent classically in polynomial time to an additive error of one over polynomial. Okay. Now this is, you know, this seems to be saying that you can simulate this linear optics classically, but this is actually of limited use for us because in the linear optics setting, almost all of these permanents, you know, are going to be exponentially small anyway, right? So you could also just estimate it to a 1 over polynomial additive error by just outputting 0, you know, to within my limit, it's, you know, this thing is 0, right? But, you know, what Gurvitz is showing is that if these things happen to be large, then, you know, you can figure that out classically in polynomial time. Okay. And and then there's also okay. There's also this fact that if your inputs happen to be coherent states, so they had this form instead of just being a single photon, they're like a superposition over 0 photons, 1 photon, 2 photons, and so forth, with the number of photons following a Poisson distribution. Okay, then you could actually take your whole circuit and simulate it efficiently with a classical computer. Okay, now, you know, when I first saw this, I said, you know, why on earth would you consider these, you know, types of, you know, of all the states you could consider? Well, it turns out that apparently this is what a laser outputs. So, okay, so that's I guess that's one reason to consider it. Fine. So, you know, also it just it's a very nice fact that it can be simulated in classical polynomial time. What?
The physics and the
touch. Okay.
It was also the fermions.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you, Ben.
Okay.
It should
be discovered by
Lenin. Yeah, right. Oh, and this, I reproved for myself, why can this be simulated efficiently classically? And I told a physicist about that, and he said, well, this is what Glauber did, apparently. So I said, okay, fine. So it doesn't surprise me that I was beat to this, but, you know, okay, fine. Okay, so... all right, so we're finally ready for, you know, our first sort of simple result, new result, I guess. So where should I put it? How about here? Okay, so this says is that suppose that there were a polynomial time classical algorithm that sampled from the same distribution that this linear optics circuit is sampling from. Okay, then you know, you would get a huge collapse of classical complexity classes. Okay, so p to the sharp p would equal bpp to the np, which in particular, because of TOTUS theorem, would imply that the polynomial hierarchy would collapse, okay, to the third level. Yeah.
Because BPP?
Yeah, because it's BPP. Maybe you can... BPP is only known to be in the second level. Yeah. I mean, you know, I thought a little bit about whether you could improve this to the second level. I'm not sure. Okay, so, you know, I could give... I had like a more complexity theoretic proof, but actually I just the other day noticed a very simple proof that uses the KLM theorem. Okay, so you can say by using the KLM construction, if you wanted to do boson sampling, you know, plus post-selection on measurement outcomes, okay? So you could make measurement outcomes and, you know, and just condition on, you know, there being zero photons here, one photon here, and so forth. Then we could actually do not only, you know, universal quantum computation, but even quantum computation with post-selection, okay? Which is this complexity class that I called post-BQP years ago, okay? Okay, but then I also have a result that says that post-BQP is equal to PP. Okay, PP is this class where you get to like accept if the number of possible, you know, solutions is greater than some threshold and reject if the number of solutions is less than that threshold. Okay, you know, in particular, it's known that P to the PP, and this is a simple exercise, the P with a PP oracle is the same as P with a sharp P oracle. Basically, because you can do binary search to get an exact count of the number of solutions. Okay, so basically, PP is an extremely powerful class. It basically contains the whole power of sharp P. Okay, so quantum computers with post-selection actually have the entire power of sharp P. Okay, and this is a known fact. Okay. Okay, but suppose that boson sampling were in BPP, then boson sampling with post-selection on measurement outcomes would be in post-BPP, right? So by doing a classical probabilistic computation and conditioning on measurement outcomes, we could simulate this class, and this is this class has another name, which is BPP path. And in any case, what's important is that it's known that this classical computation with post-selected measurement outcomes is contained in the polynomial hierarchy. Okay, this is another known fact. Yeah.
Is this supposed to be an exact simulation?
Oh, yeah. So this is, you know, let's say with multiplicative error, you know, you can allow multiplicative error.
For every outcome.
Yes. Okay. And yeah, and it brings up an obvious question, which is can you deal with, you know, can you show that even an approximate sample would have this consequence? So that, and that's what we've been working on for the last few months, and I was going to tell you next about what we have for that case. Okay, this is just the sort of the warm up to that.
Sure.
Okay, so, yeah. Okay, so, okay. And this means that BPP path would equal PP. So, P to the sharp P, you know, would equal P to the PP, would equal P to the BPP path. It's contained in pH. And therefore, pH would collapse to finite level. Okay. So, and this is actually there's a number of related results that are known. One due to Fenner, Green, Homer, and Pruham. One is due to actually recently independently of us due to Bremner, Joza, and Shepard. So, right. So, you know, basically, once you see it, this is not that surprising, right? I mean, we've known for a while that quantum, you know, computing, you know, somehow, you know, quantum computing plus post-selection, in any case, gives you the power to solve sharp P problems, right? And this is basically what we're exploiting. Okay, another way to say this is that, in some sense, boson sampling is sharp P complete under BPP to the NP reductions. Okay, so it's sharp P complete, but only in this very, you know, you need to be a BPP to the NP machine in order to extract the sharp P completeness from it. Okay, and there's one further thing, which is that you need to, you know, assuming that you have like an oracle for boson sampling, you need to be able to choose the random string that that oracle gets, right? So it has to be that like it's, you have actually a classical algorithm, like where the, you know, a classical sampling algorithm where the output just, you know, is only a function of some fixed random string, which you get to pick as the input. Okay, otherwise you don't get the simulation in BPP path. Yeah.
The statement of the book was if, suppose, blah, 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 then P to sharp P, BPP to the NP.
Yeah.
And in the barrage of complexity classes down at the bottom there, is BPP to the NP hiding in there somewhere?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, yeah. Good. Thanks. That's where it is. Sorry. It was hiding.
So you got P to BPP path is a substitute.
Okay, so this is because of a trick which is known as approximate counting. So turns out that like in you can if you have BPP and you also have an NP oracle, so you have a probabilistic polynomial time classical computer with an oracle for NP, then you can actually estimate like the like what fraction of random strings cause some sampler to produce a certain thing in output. Okay, even if that fraction is exponentially small, you can still estimate it. Really, this is like a trick from the 80s, and basically the idea is to use hash functions. So you use random hash. So you can ask, okay, does there exist a string that causes the sampler to, you know, output the outcome that I care about? Okay, it does. Well, then that at least tells me that the amplitude is non-zero. Right, there was some probability of the thing being output. Okay, now if I want a better estimate, I can say, well, does there exist a random string that causes me to output this n such that the random string hashes to this value under this hash function? Right, and then I keep doing that for a bunch of different choices of hash function. I collect together all the answers, and that gives me some multiplicative estimate of what the of what fraction of random strings, you know, cause the machine to output what I want, even if that fraction is exponentially small. Okay, so yeah. Okay, so you know, as Daniel already alluded to, this theorem is kind of unsatisfying because you know, we could never prove that some linear optics machine that we built was sampling exactly from some probability distribution D. Right? At best, you know, we could prove that the machine was sampling from a distribution which was close in variation distance to the true one. Chris?
Yeah. How is it that being able to efficiently simulate classically implies post-selection?
Oh, well, so it doesn't, but okay, well, if we could simulate classically, if we could sample from this distribution in BPP, then in classical computing plus post-selection, we could simulate from this distribution and post-select on an outcome. Right? So I'm not assuming post-selection. I'm just saying, you know, then if you had the power of post-selection, then you could sample from this distribution, you know, which we assumed is efficiently doable, and also post-select on an outcome. Okay, so... at best, you know, we could say that, you know, our machine is sampling from some distribution D prime, which is like, which has total variation distance at most 1 over a polynomial at n from our correct distribution D. Right, and we would like to say that, you know, that even that would have like kind of if we could sample from D prime efficiently classically, that this would already have staggering complexity consequences. Okay, so we can get some results here. You know, and there's a conjecture
under which we could really get the result that we wanted. Okay, so okay, so let me just state the theorem. Okay. Okay. All right. So so given a linear optic circuit U, I want to let D sub U be the probability distribution, you know, which is induced by U. So in other words, the distribution over possible photon counts that results from, you know, starting in the standard basis state, applying U, and then measuring and, you know, measuring the photon number, you know, in each mode and outputting whatever we observe. Okay, and now I want to suppose that there were a classical efficient algorithm that sampled not necessarily from DU itself, but just from any distribution which was close to DU in variation distance. Okay, one over polynomial close. Okay, which is sort of the physically more realistic assumption. Okay, then what we show is that even this would have, you know, I think a surprising consequence for complexity theory, and just how surprising, you know, is an open problem. But what we show is that then within the polynomial hierarchy, particular in BPP to the NP, one could additively estimate the permanent of a matrix of independent Gaussian entries with high probability over the choice of such matrix. Okay, and yes. There is, yes.
This is factorial one.
Yes, okay, and now, and why is this?
So this is not exponential increasing?
Oh, it is. I mean, of course it is, but the permanent itself. So that the key point here is that the permanent of X itself, if X is, you know, it has like independent Gaussian entries of mean 0 and variance 1, then its permanent will tend to be about square root of n factorial. Okay, and that's the reason for this factor here. Okay, so we're saying, you know, you get to additively approximate the permanent to a factor that's like the standard deviation of the permanent itself divided by some polynomial.
So could you adjust that relative error 1 over poly, or is that?
So that's, yeah, I think we could have. I typically think in terms of additive error, because that's sort of what arises.
Maybe some additional with high probability, because you might index it as a small
probability. That's true. But then again, we're only assuming that we succeed with high probability over x anyway.
So is the word probability in the next line?
What?
Did you mean to write the word with probability in the next line?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Robin. Okay. So now, we have an audacious conjecture in classical complexity theory, which we call the permanent of Gaussian conjecture, or PGC. And it says that that problem, the problem that I said here, is Sharpe P. Hart. Okay, so this is sort of an inside joke. There's one of the central problems in classical theoretical computer science is called the UGC, the unique games conjecture. It says it's something that's clearly NP-hard, that everyone knows is NP-hard, is indeed NP-hard. Okay, and you know, it's been open for a while. This is saying something which is clearly should be Sharpe-Hart is indeed Sharpe-Hart. Okay, so so basically that, you know, estimating the permanent of a matrix over the reals or the complex numbers with Gaussian entries, you know, with high probability over such a matrix is a Sharpe-Hart problem. Okay, that's the conjecture, basically. So yeah, problem.
Because I'm going to have to leave and miss the rest of your talk.
It's ending anyway.
I look at this problem, and it looks like for large Gaussian things, there should be some sort of a law of large numbers argument that says that there's concentration of measure.
That's absolutely true. There is concentration of measure.
And
So here's the key point. So if you look at what the it's not quite, you know, Gaussian distributed. It's, you know, the permanent of a random matrix. It's a little bit more heavy tailed than that, right? But there is some concentration of measure, and basically, normally the permanent will not be, you know, that much larger in absolute value than square root of n factorial. Maybe it'll be twice that, or three times that, you know, or whatever, right? But, you know, but because basically what we're doing is we're summing n factorial terms. Right, each one could be, let's say, you know, about 1 or about minus 1, right? It's, you know, so you get huge cancellations, and the residue that's left over will tend to be about square root of n factorial. Okay, now I'm saying I want you to estimate the permanent within a smaller factor than that. Okay? So this seems hard. In particular, you know, intuitively, it seems sharply hard. Okay, so, you know, and now, yeah.
Oh, what is the intuition?
Okay, so I was just about to say that. Thank you. So the intuition is there are very famous known results in computer science that say that not only is the permanent a Sharpe-Hart problem, it's a very special kind of Sharpe-Hart problem. So, so one thing we know is that over a finite field, the permanent is what's called a random self-reducible problem. Okay, which means that if you can compute the permanent, let's say over some finite field, FP, right? If you can compute the permanent of most matrices over that field, most n by n matrices, then you can actually also compute the permanent over all matrices from that field. Okay, the average case is every bit as hard as the worst case. And so, you know, how could that be? Well, let's say you want to know the permanent of X for some given matrix X, right? Then what you do is you can choose a uniformly random other matrix Y. Okay, and now define function P of T, which will be equal to the permanent of X plus T times Y. Okay, now what can we say about this P? Well, first of all, we know obviously P of 0 is just the permanent of X, the thing that we wanted, right? But the other thing we can say is that P of T is actually a polynomial in T of degree at most n. Right, because the permanent is a degree n polynomial, right? You just get it from multiplying a bunch of, you know, terms that are all linear in T, right? Each of the individual matrix entries here is linear in T, so you get a degree n polynomial. And now, whenever you have a low degree polynomial, you can do this trick of polynomial interpolation, right? So now we can, you know, we can use the fact that for every non-zero T, X plus T times Y is just a random matrix, right? Because we're just adding in some random matrix, right, over the finite field, and that just randomizes everything, right? So now, by assumption, you know, with high probability, we can compute, you know, P of 1, P of 2, P of 3, and so forth, you know, or at any rate, most of them, you know, if not all of them. Okay, but now if you've got a low degree polynomial and you can estimate its values on most points, then we know that you can also get its values on all points. Okay, this is because polynomials are basically an error correcting code. Okay, you know, you can use what's called the Burlikamp-Welch algorithm, you know, and, you know, just find a polynomial that passes through most of your sample values. And then, you know, and then if you find such a polynomial, evaluate it at the point zero, and then with high probability, you'll get the permanent of your target matrix X. Okay, so this is, you know, a very beautiful thing. It has all sorts of applications in complexity theory. And now the task is merely to generalize this from finite fields to the reals or complex numbers. Okay, and unfortunately, you know, when we do this, you find that new difficulties arise. The basic difficulty is is interpolation error. Okay, so what you can do. So first of all, we can actually prove an analog of this LFKN theorem over the reals or over the complex numbers, but it assumes that you can exactly get the permanents of the sample matrices, right? So there's sort of two sources of fuzziness, right, in this problem, right? One is that we're only getting the permanents of most matrices, and the other one is that we're only approximating the permanents of those most matrices. Okay, if you remove either of those two sources of fuzziness, then we can prove that the problem is Sharpe complete. Okay, so the challenge is to show that it's still Sharpe complete when you have both sources of fuzziness together. Okay, so you can generalize this, you know, Lipton LFKN idea to the reals or complex numbers. For example, one way to do it is to, instead of interpolating with a random line like you do here, you interpolate by a random trigonometric polynomial that passes through your target matrix. Okay, but now if you also, you know, assume that you only have approximations to the target matrices, then what could happen is so here's your true matrix. So here's your true P of T function, and here's P at your sample point, you know, and here's the permanent of the matrix that you really wanted. And now you have these samples from other matrices, which are a little bit off. Okay, so they're a little bit off from the truth. Okay, well, then it turns out that this can cause a huge problem when you come to your target point. This can mean that your estimate at the target point, zero, is just way off from the truth. Okay, and so, you know, we seem to need a new technique for random self-reducibility that would deal with that. But, you know, if you could develop it, I think this would be very, very interesting just purely for classical complexity theory, completely independently of our application. Okay, but additionally, it would have the application that, you know, if you can build like a somewhat, you know, realistic linear optic circuit, quote unquote realistic, right? And, you know, at least with the, you know, you can push the photon losses, you know, very, very close to zero, you know, I mean, not quite zero. You can, you know, you can generate states that are very, very close to single photon Fock states. You know, you can measure very accurately the photon number at each mode. Then you would be able to do a physical experiment. You know, you could prove that nature could compute something that if a classical computer could compute the same thing, then the polynomial hierarchy would collapse. Okay, I think that would be a very exciting thing. So so I think I'll end the formal talk here, and then if there's more questions, I'm happy to stay for as long as people like. Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Is there any relation between the way in which you bosonize the permanent and this, I don't know if you know it, this idea of Horace Ewan of Northwestern, permanent, you know?
So I don't know this particular idea.
There is a very different meat of which, maybe it's related, maybe it's worse, probably, I don't know. You just take the tensor power of the matrix you want to evaluate the permanent of. And then you take a totally symmetric state tensor product with any orthonormal basis. Then you take the expectation of this state, and this is the permanent, apart from n factorial, is the permanent of the matrix. And then you you measure this matrix element by tomography, for example.
Okay, but I assume that you probably need exponentially many samples.
There is a statistical error, right? Which goes down the usual way, by the central limit theorem.
Mm-hmm.
But you have an error there.
Yes.
Which anyway should go down statistically if you repeat your experiment, because it's probabilistic, right?
Okay. So the key thing is that, you know, like, if anything, you know, like, if you have any idea for bringing the permanent into quantum computing that seems to be giving you an efficient way to actually compute the permanent with a quantum computer, then, you know, check what's going on, because almost certainly, you know, there's some bad approximation being made somewhere. I mean, you know, because we don't, you know, for sharp peak complete problems to be in BQP, it would just be a staggering, you know, thing, right? So you know, what I'm guessing is going on here is that, you know, you can get various estimators for the permanent, even classically. You can get, you know, very interesting estimators. Well, they generally take an exponential amount of time to converge. Okay, so here, what we're saying is that, you know, you can get an estimator of the permanent, which is much more accurate than that. But, you can really physically do it with a quantum computer. But the catch is that you don't get to pick the matrix that you get the permanent of. Okay, you just, you know, you take your bosonic system, you make a measurement, you find some, you know, photon configuration, and then you're able to deduce that the corresponding submatrix of your unitary scattering matrix, you know, probably had a larger than average permit. Okay, it's more likely than chance to have had a fairly large permit. Okay, now, but you don't get to pick which matrix you learn that about. Okay, now, the key thing that, you know, that we're saying in our result is that even that sort of weird thing where you don't get to, you learn about the permanent but not about a matrix of your choosing, you know, even this, if you could simulate the same thing with a classical computer, would have very surprising consequences for classical complexity theory. Okay, it wouldn't mean that you could compute the permanent in P, but it would mean that at least you could estimate the permanent for most matrices in the polynomial hierarchy, okay, which seems very unlikely. Yeah.
So this is something I'm a little bit uncomfortable about. Maybe if you can ease my mind. The structure of the argument of your theorem is that
if boson sampling at the same computational power is something in BPP,
mm-hmm.
then were I to supplement each of those with post-selection, I would get two things which have the same computational power,
yeah.
and then your results follow.
Yeah.
What, is it conceivable that maybe imagining supplementation with post-selection just involves some sort of inconsistency? I mean, we know that we can't post-select in the real world.
Right.
Could it be that actually, you know, all you should conclude is that no, imagining post-selection is just inconsistent?
I don't think so, no. Because, you know, I mean, you can define a complexity class, right? The fact that, like, we can't solve NP complete problems in the real world doesn't mean that the class NP involves a mathematical inconsistency, right? So, you know, so the way to think about it is that we're trying to get evidence that a real problem in the real world, you know, is hard to solve classically. Right, and the evidence that that real problem is hard to solve classically is that if we could solve it classically, then two things that are way up in outer space would collapse with each other. Right, now these things up in outer space are not realistic things, but nevertheless, you know, we believe as complexity theorists that the one thing is way higher up in outer space than the other thing is. Okay, so for them to collapse would be very surprising, and in fact, they would collapse if this thing, you know, in the real world were solvable efficiently. Okay, so we're, you know, we're getting conclusions about the real world, you know, by reasoning about outer space. You know, look, this has a long history in physics, right? Newton did the same thing. Oh, and I, just for the experimenters, I just wanted to make a comment that, what I would suggest doing, you know, if you could actually implement this, is to focus on, you know, experiments with where, you know, where it's difficult but not impossible to simulate what's going on with a classical computer. Okay? So for example, if you could do this experiment with 20 photons, 30 photons, you know, which, you know, very laughing, but you know, to me that seems like a very small number, right? So then, you know, what you could do, you know, you could do something where you know, like a classical, you know, you could indeed verify with a classical computer that the outputs, you know, are correspond to submatrices of your input matrix that have large permanence, that have larger than average permanence. But the classical computer would have a hard time keeping up. Okay, and you could see that the quantum, you know, the linear optic circuit is doing very quickly what takes a long time for your classical computer. And I think that would give you some sort of evidence that the, you know, extended Church-Turing thesis is being violated in nature.
The 24 down is where you see is roughly the limit.
Well, I want let n be the number of photons. Then, you know, what we want is some n such that computing the permanent of an n by n matrix is difficult but not impossible for a classical computer.
And that's where the 20 comes from.
Yeah. And then, maybe this will make you laugh harder, but in order to make this theorem work, we would like the number of modes to be roughly quadratic in the number of photons, which would mean, you know, several hundred modes, maybe 400 or something. And then the number of beam splitters and phase shifters will in general be quadratic in the number of modes. So but these are all things that, you know, one hopes, you know, could be improved with some further thought. What?
How good is the photo?
Pretty damn good. Yeah, we would like the accuracy to be like a 1/polynomial, ideally. But actually, there is a further, you know, question here, which is, you know, how hard is it to do quantum error correction on top of this, right? Like, could it be, you know, probably hard, but could it be, you know, less hard than doing like the error correction that would be needed for a universal quantum? Daniel shaking his head, no. Okay, well, you know, I think it's worth thinking about at any rate.
So is there an indication you can do error correction just with the linear?
Well, okay, I mean, we know that you can do it if you have linear optics plus post-selection, like a KLM thing, right? But the problem is, at that point, you know, you already might as well do Shor's algorithm, right? You've got your quantum computer. So, you know, is there some easier way to, you know, encode things in some decoherence-free subspace here, you know, I don't know. Yeah.
There's one thing which I understand that fermions are anti-symmetric and bosons are already symmetric, but you know, by qubits I can prepare any state I want, simulating any state I want. So what about to use instead a few qubits and have the same states that you have with qubits?
Oh, you can absolutely do that. And
it would be easier to do that.
Maybe it would. Maybe it would. I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, it, look, you know, absolutely. Absolutely, you could do it that way. I mean, in fact, originally, you know, I was, you know, thinking about, you know, we were thinking about linear optics for reasons that have nothing to do with physics. We just wanted to get the permanent into our problem one way or another. Right, but then, you know, then it occurred to us that, well, you know, linear optics happens to be an implementation proposal that might be, you know, easier than the qubit.
So if you have a quadratic number of beam speakers that is a quadratic number of bones, which is a quadratic number.
Actually, I can tell you.
Easier.
Okay, so actually, well, let me tell you why we want the number of modes to be quadratic in the number of photons, because it's very interesting, actually. Problem is that, you know, a photon being bosons like to clump on top of each other, right? And in fact, you know, even more likely to do that than classical particles are, right? And, you know, it happens in lasers and Bose-Einstein condensates and whatever. And, you know, if suppose that our final state was dominated by, like, by basis states with lots of photons, like, clumped together into a few modes, right? Well, in that case, maybe we're not computing the permanent of any interesting matrix, right? Because we have too many repeated rows and columns here. You know, and certainly, you know, for repeated rows and columns, it looks nothing like a Gaussian random matrix, which is really, you know, what we're interested in. So basically, what we want, what we have to analyze is something that we call the bosonic birthday paradox. Okay, so classically, we know that, like, if you want to throw n particles into m bins in such a way that probably no two particles land in the same bin, then you need m to be about n squared. Okay, then the question is, well, what about with bosons? Because bosons like to clump together more. So what we show is that with bosons, well, it's a little bit worse than with classical particles, but basically if you take m to be like 2n squared, then you're fine. Okay, so this is basically for birthday paradox reasons that we want the number of nodes to be quadratic, but there may be a different way to solve this problem that would let you get by with a linear number of nodes. Yeah.
So have you looked at the statistics of actual birthdays to see if they're bosonic or not?
I haven't actually. I mean, I know that they're not uniform. So, for example, birthdays tend to be clumped like about 9 months after major holidays.
maybe that's because they're bosons.
So Greg Cooperberg has a beautiful way to think of like a random boson distribution, right? So like, let's say, you know, you just like threw, you know, n bosons into, you know, like randomly into m nodes, and you're interested in the statistics, right? Then it's equivalent to saying just choose a random point from the probability syntax, right, over m possible outcomes. And then once you fix that point, that, you know, which gives you a distribution, then choose n independent samples from that distribution. And that will exactly reproduce the correlations of, you know, of bosons that occurs because of the exchange interaction. I thought that was really nice.
I mean, you choose one point in this.
Yeah, you choose a random point from the probability simplex, okay. And then, you know, that will be close to uniform, but not quite, right? It'll have little fluctuations in it. Okay, then choose, you know, n independent samples from that distribution. Okay, so then, you know, the points, you know, there will be some correlations. Okay, so as a simple example of that, suppose you have two modes and two particles, right? And then we throw them, you know, each particle in a random box, and we ask, what is the probability that both particles land in the same box? Okay, now with classical particles, it's obvious that the answer is a half, right? Because, we have four possibilities, like, we could have first one here, second one here, or we could have first one here, second one here. right? So obviously, there's half probability in the two of them weigh up the same box, okay? But with bosons, it's more than that. It's two-thirds, because these two states are the same state.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there a way to think about fermionic statistics with this alternative in front of you? The one you mentioned with Rick Cooper for flights.
Oh, yeah. Well, so with fermions, it's actually much simpler. There you would just take, you know, n, you would just choose n modes uniformly random and without replacement. Because with fermions, you have the Pauli exclusion principle. So you never have two of them in the same node. Right, so that they actually completely like repel each other from being in the same node. So then it's just there's n choose n possibilities, right, for where the n fermions could be, and you pick one of them, and that's it. Right, so that's the story of the fermions.
Okay, I guess it's time to close the nice. Thank you.
Okay.
Oh, thank you for staying.